Accession number 9474, Reel 1.
Mr. George Harbottle, Reel 1. Could you tell me your date and place of birth?
I was born in the Grove in Gosforth, which is an old terrace house built somewhere around about 1854, and it has gardens running down to the cricket field. And I was born on the 26th of August, 1893, which happened to be a Saturday afternoon, and I therefore was born within sound of a cricket bat and ball, and I've been into that cricket field as soon as I could climb the fence, and I'm afraid that I've been there for a very long time. In fact, I'm still president of the club.
Can you tell me a little about your father?
My father was what is called a colliery fitter. That is to say, he is the sales agent for one of the old privately owned collieries. And the company was the Weardale Steel Coal and Coke Company, big Durham coal company, and also the Easington Coal Company. And he was until he was in his 80s, he was still selling the coal because it was still a commercial world without nationalisation.
So you had a fairly comfortable background, would you say?
Well, it was just my elder brother, who was a solicitor, and myself. I hadn't got the necessary brains to be a solicitor or anything professional. I was simply pushed onto the quayside and started life as an office boy.
Before that, what sort of education did you get? What school?
I was attended a preparatory school in Gosforth. Which in those days, from the age of about 8 or 9, you until you were about 11 or 12, you walked up the road, across the high street, and way up to your prep school twice a day. But after that, I went to the Lees School at Cambridge, which would be from the age of 13.
What can you remember about the Lees School? What sort of education did you get there?
I can tell you a lot about that because I made several rude remarks about it one time and another. I consider that the history, which was taught by a man called Kellett, was first class, the English was good, but the French was pretty hopeless. The mathematics I didn't think were particularly good either. And I came away with pretty good marks on things like history, English, scripture, but pretty poor ones in languages and in mathematics.
What was the sort of daily routine like at Lee's school? What would you do?
Well, we had the criminal business of a 7:30 lesson in the morning in the summer term, which was, I may say, was disliked as much by the masters as by the boys. that was dissolved soon after I left, I believe. But at any rate, we worked from prayers, of course, and then the morning lessons up till 12:30, and then lunch, and in the afternoon was mostly games, and then we started again at 5:20 and did another two periods until 6:15, and then evening prayers, and then a meal, which wasn't all that marvelous, but still we got a meal then, and then into your house to do your preparation. And there were no studies for the except for the prefects. They simply had the classroom. There was one classroom in each house, and you simply used your classroom to do your preparation amongst the noise of all the other people going on.
What were the teaching methods like? Was it very formal? The actual teaching methods by which...
Yes, they varied very much with the master. Pretty formal and pretty standardized. And as I say, some of the masters were good and some of them weren't all that marvellous.
What was discipline like?
Discipline? Oh, first class. And by gum, you get your backside tanned if you didn't behave yourself.
What about, did the prefects, would there still be a system of fagging at that time, or was it...
The prefects were responsible to the masters for the discipline, and they didn't mince matters about that. And then there were sub-prefects who had only jurisdiction in the dormitory, when you were in the dormitory. They were eventually moved up to be prefect if they were good enough.
What about the games? You mentioned cricket.
Oh yes, well yeah, the games were the standard games. I mean, it was cricket in the summer. You could play tennis in your own time, but cricket was the game, and you had to play it. And rugger was the game in the winter. Although in the spring term we played lacrosse, which is unusual there at that time. It was the idea was at that time that lacrosse was a better game than hockey, and was going to be a developing game which had been brought over from Canada. And there's no doubt about it, it was an excellent game, but the trouble was that we couldn't get school matches, and so they gave it up and turned over to hockey.
What sort of ethos did the school have? Was it a school where you were set to go on to university, Oxford or Cambridge, or was it meant to be an education in itself?
Well, education in itself, but a good many went on to the university, but many of them, I mean, you after all, you had to get to the little go to get into Cambridge, and you worked up to that, and if you didn't pass there, you didn't go to the university, and of course some of them were good enough to get scholarships.
Did you enjoy your time at the school?
Oh yes, I did, because I concentrated mostly upon games, which I was very keen about. I enjoyed my time there, and there was a certain amount of bullying, you know, and a bit of rough house business, but at the same time, life wasn't bad.
What sort of bullying was indulged in? What sort of bullying was it?
You can get somebody that would go for a youngster and chuck him into the swimming bath and that sort of thing. Nothing very much bullying in the dormitories or anything of that kind.
Did you get as much prestige from being good at games as you would have been good at academic?
Yes. There was In fact, people, the trouble was that the brilliant boys, people looked down their noses at them, rather, and hadn't much use for them. It was purely the boys who did best at games were the ones that were looked up to.
Did you become a prefect?
No. I left because, unfortunately, I had to leave school very early. You see, the going onto the quayside, it was regarded as quite wrong to be too late in getting down there. You were supposed to start at 14. And for that reason, I left school when I was just at the end of my 16th year.
Just one point before we leave Leeds School. Did it have an officers' training corps or any form of...
Yes. Oh, yes. I was in the corps, and we used to go to the to the camp in July. We used to go to Farnborough, and then and the whole situation was changed when they became, instead of cadet corps, they became officers training corps, and when the territorial force had been formed, and we were working towards the territorial force.
Could you tell me when would you join the officers training corps? What year?
I joined in 1907.
So that would be when you were 14.
Yes, that's right. And we went to the camp at Farnborough.
Did you get issued with a uniform when you joined? Was it a
yes, were a very ill-fitting uniform, but nevertheless a uniform.
Was it the normal khaki?
Yes, that's right.
And could you tell me about not covering the camp? But what was the routine of training while you were actually in the school?
The training at the school was mainly just ordinary drill, but quite a lot of shooting, because we had our own range, and the shooting was very important. And of course, we all sent a shooting aide to Bisley.
This shooting, was it with what rifle were you using? Was it a small bore?
We were using an ordinary rifle, but with a small bore in the barrel, because it was only firing 2.2s. But it was the full size rifle you were using. I don't know how they adapted it.
Did it not have as much kick on the shoulder?
Yes. Well, you didn't get as much kick with that as you did with the real thing. But of course, eventually, you see, we used to go and fire on the range at Cambridge, and that taught us what a rifle really was like.
Who taught you the drill and the rifle? You know, this small.
We had the school sergeant was an old regular soldier, and he. He taught us the shooting, and as a matter of fact, we had some masters who were pretty officers in the training corps, and were themselves pretty good soldiers.
So, did you enjoy this first experience of military life?
Oh yes,
training.
Oh yeah, we got a lot of fun out of that.
What did you like about it?
Not so much the drill. It's good to be in a well drilled unit, and trying to see that your school was better than the other ones, because there were all schools at the camps, other schools, and you had to show up well with them. The field days were the greatest thing. That was grand fun.
What? Tell me about a field day.
Oh well, you had to do probably some attack in open country or a defending position, and you had blank ammunition. That's all fun to boys.
Had you been trained in this sort of tactical exercises?
Yes, very largely on the blackboard, you know, by the opposing 24 master.
So the field days were your first opportunities to put it into practice?
Yes, that's right.
How did it go? Was it as you'd imagined from the blackboard?
Oh, it wasn't bad. I mean, I'm looking back on it from wartime experiences, and I don't think they were doing too badly.
Now, the field days, were they separate from the annual camps, or were they part?
No, they were part of the camp.
They were part of the camp.
Yes.
What else went on at the camp? You were presumably under canvas, were you?
We were under canvas. That's right.
Can you tell me a little about a typical camp at Farnborough?
The thing was that everything had to be absolutely tidy. Your blankets that you'd use had to be rolled up in a certain manner and stuck outside, and you were crammed if you didn't get everything absolutely dead right. So that was pretty good training.
And besides the actual field day, what else would you do on one of these camps?
Very little. You'd probably do a route march or two, and you'd probably, when you were done in that part, you went to Bisley and were shooting at Bisley, which was great fun.
That's with the real rifle.
That's a genuine article. I mean, you're probably starting at 200 and going right back to 500.
Were you taught at this stage to do anything more than fire the rifle? Were you taught how to maintain it, to clean it, to unjam it and such like? Or were you just taught how to fire it?
Oh, you were taught how to fire, but you were given a target. When you're firing the 200 yards, probably you'd be a company of 200 all firing on a certain target. And that was a test as to what the firing of the unit was like.
But would you be taught how to clean your rifle and maintain your rifle at this stage?
Oh yes, that was all part of your routine. 4x2, put them through.
So you got quite a detailed military training.
Yes, that's right. You see, we were supposed to be, when you left school, you got Certificate A. You were supposed, therefore, to have qualified to become an officer in the Territorial Force.
And you fully intended, before you left school, to do this?
Well, I didn't actually, because I left school early, I didn't take my Certificate A.
Who basically decided that you should leave school at 16? Was it your wish, or was it the
family? Oh, my father. You did as you were told in those days.
Did you have any opinion about it, or did you just...
No, I didn't bother my head. That was the order of the day, and I conformed.
Now, you said you went on to the quayside. Could you explain exactly what your job was going to be?
I see. Quayside. Well, you see, quayside life is something so described because the Newcastle quayside is where the commercial exchange is. That is where, in my early days, all the business of the commercial world was done on the floor of the exchange. On the floor of the exchange, which is quite a sizable place, there would be as many as 500 people there every morning. And there was a session in the morning and a session again in the afternoon. And it was attended by the... ship owners, ship brokers, coal exporters, collieries, the business was done there on the floor of the exchange. And if you wanted to, you had there was a telegraph office on the exchange. There were 10 telephone boxes, it was really the hub of the universe. And of course, telegrams were so very quick in those days. I could go into the on the floor of the exchange into the post office box there, put a telegram in for Copenhagen, and I would know that it would be on the person's desk in 20 minutes. It was as quick as that.
Could you explain exactly how this business was conducted?
Yes, well, you see, the collieries were the key of the whole thing, and each colliery had its sales agent, known as a colliery fitter, and they attended on the floor of the exchange, and when you wanted to buy coal, you had to go to them. That was only for the day-to-day business, but as a rule, at the beginning of the year, a great many companies would buy a whole chunk of gas coal from some colliery supplying gas coal, and they knew they could sell it to Italy or France, and therefore they were responsible to the colliery for the sales of that coal. And then with the in, for instance, like Northumberland coal, which was a steam coal, large coal, a lot of that was used for bunkering ships, bunkering trawlers, and the people would buy whole section of Ashington Coal Company's coal over the year, by 100,000 tons over the year, and then they would retail it out. And so that there was constant movement on the floor of the exchange. You could, a man, you didn't need to go to the colliery to buy the coal. You could go to somebody who was a contractor. And there was a great deal of buying and selling on the floor of the exchange. And some people there who had no business other than buying and selling on the floor of the exchange and made a living.
They never actually did any selling at the final end. They were just middlemen.
That's right. But you see, then ships, the Scandinavian ships, all these Copenhagen ships, they would you would get as a ship broker, which I was trained to be. You would get a telegram would come in, a 2,000 tonner ready the next week, destination required to the Baltic. Any offers, you see, and you'd go around and find somebody who wanted a ship of that size, and you'd send your telegram off to the ship owner and say, right, I've got this ship, here's a cargo for her, I can get such and such a rate of freight. He would come back, no, that's not enough, I want so and so. And there you are. And all that was going on all the time.
Now, you say you were going to be a shipbroker, not a coal fitter. Why didn't you follow in your father's footsteps? Did he think that the opportunities were greater?
Because he considered the best training for the whole life of the Quayside was to be a shipbroker, because there you're in touch with everybody as a shipbroker. You're in touch with the ship owners abroad, ship owners here, collieries, stemming of ships for such and such a date, the loading of ships. It gave you the whole picture, and that's why he put me onto that. And I was with a firm of ship owners who were also shipbrokers, Cairns Noble and Company.
How did they go about training you? What was their training program that they put you through?
You were put you went in to start with as an office boy. And that meant that you'd got to do all the filing, do the copying of letters, and that was something. The copying of letters, because every letter had to be copied in a copy book. You had a copy book of a thin paper, and it was done with a damp sheet. You had two sheets of waterproof sheets, and you put a waterproof sheet down. You put a damp linen thing, and then your flimsy piece of paper, and then your letter on that, and then another sheet, and a whole lot of these. And then you put it into a letter press and squeeze it down, and the pressure of the press pressed the letter against the flimsy paper, and that gave you your copy. And if you got too much water on your piece of linen, you got smudged letter, and there was hell on. And if you didn't get it enough on, you didn't get a true copy. So that it was pretty tricky, that, and you learnt the hard way.
They didn't have carbon paper in those days, then?
Well, if it was typed, yes, but a great many letters were written, handwritten in those days. You see, this was prior to 1914, and a great many of the letters were still being written. Well, I came on the quayside in 1910, and 10 to 12, there was a great deal of still handwritten letters.
So, besides the filing and the copying of the letters in this manner, what other responsibilities would you have as a junior?
Well, you had to clear a ship at the custom house. You had to get the ship's masters, you see, would come in, and they had to get a clearance at the custom house before they could sail. And you had to get all the necessary papers right, with your jerk note and your sheet with the provisions on, and where she's sailing for, the light dues that had to be paid, and all these documents had to, the office boy had to get those all right and take them along, and if they weren't right at the custom house, then the papers were just thrown back at you. You had to learn the hard way.
Anything else that you had to do?
You had to take money to a master who had to pay his crew off. I have gone with a little bag, these little leather bags that you used to have in those days, with 200 sovereigns in it, because it was sovereigns and half sovereigns, and a few £5 notes, and you go down in the to Tyne Dock or up to Dunstan or wherever the ship happened to be, and the master would pay his crew off. You were entrusted with all that money in those days.
Was there any security precaution, though, for you? I mean...
No. There was very little security needed. It was a much more reasonable world than it is today.
So, these duties, did they gradually increase in the amount of responsibility that was put upon you? How did you train?
Then the great thing was to be able to get out onto the commercial exchange. And it was there, you see, when you got out there, that you began to know all the people, and you began to be somebody.
Now, you arrived in 1910. When was it you were allowed on the exchange?
Actually, I was pretty early, because two people left in the office, and I got out in 1912, which was unusually early.
So you had 2 years of this office boy.
That's right.
Right. When you got to the exchange, presumably you weren't thrown in at the deep end. How did they train you actually on the floor of the exchange?
You did the thing right or you didn't do the thing right, and you simply learned by trial and error. So, and of course, there was the question of knowing whether the man you were talking to with your ship, who wouldn't take less than 7 and 6 pence, and there were only bidding 7 shillings for a Baltic port, you had to know whether you could bounce him for something more, or you'd go back to your ship owner and say, sorry, 7 shillings is the maximum. It was a question of judgment of character.